Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Has the 1-2 punch of technology and the pandemic changed the way we work forever? Let's get to the bottom line. Economists are calling it the Great Resignation. It started in April when the number of Americans who quit their jobs broke all records. We're not talking about just a few people here and there. In August alone, 4.3 million Americans woke up one day and they just walked out. It's not that people don't want to work. It's just that during this pandemic, billions of us took a step back and wondered about the value of our lives. Many people decided they wouldn't keep jobs they didn't like or jobs that didn't give them what they felt they deserve. Many turned to the gig economy, where they can work as many hours per day as they want, delivering food or people, for instance, but without the benefits of the old economy. The seismic shift in the labor market is wreaking havoc everywhere, from restaurants to hospitals, with millions of jobs unfilled. So what's the future of work and workplaces? What do employers need to know if they want to attract and keep workers? And have employee-labor relations changed forever? Today, we're talking to Adam Ozimek, chief economist at the freelance job website Upwork, where he leads research on labor market trends, and Vina Dubal, professor of law at the University of California, Hastings, where she researches how digital technologies are impacting the lives of workers. Vina, let me start with you. Look, I remember when there was this romantic notion that, you know, after the 2008-2009 financial crisis, you know, people were going to have an opportunity to work a little bit here, work a little bit there. You know, we called it the gig economy, and it was to give flexibility. But then we went to a point where we began saying, wait, maybe those Uber jobs and, you know, those food delivery jobs weren't as romantic as we thought because they didn't have the right benefits. And then we talked about robots coming in and displacing all of those people. Today, we have a major gap in lots of jobs open, and we don't know where the people are. What's going on? Give us a quick frame of what's happening from your perspective.
I think that during the pandemic, as you said, a lot of people realized that what they were doing at work in their jobs was exploitative, that they didn't like answering to a boss. They didn't feel valued in their workplace. And frankly, they weren't making enough money given how much experience they had, how long they'd worked in the economy, and what they felt that they deserved. Because we are in a labor market that is a workers' labor market, a lot of people have been able to leave their jobs in unprecedented ways, unprecedented numbers, and look for something better. This also has a lot to do with the benefits, the unemployment insurance benefits, and the pandemic unemployment assistance that the government provided to give people the ability to say, hey, I haven't been appreciated in my workplace. Mm. I haven't been earning what I deserve to earn. And they're looking for other options. Many of them are making other options. But it's important as we are in this inflection point to think about what got us here. What got us here was exploitation. What got us here was a disregard for human dignity in the workplace. And as we build back, as we think about the world, the future of work for workers that we want to create, we have to take into account the lessons of the last 15 years. And those lessons include that humans need not just dignity, not just flexibility, but also stability and security.
Well, thank you, Adam. I'd love to get your take from Upwork's perspective. You've written out, I love your newsletters, that you've got basically 40 million people are now going to be working online digitally, not in corporate offices over the next 5 years. What does that world look like? And give us both what you see as the positive dimensions of that scaffolding and those that concern you.
Sure. So I think, you know, to step back, we had about a third of people doing some freelancing pre-pandemic. And it's important to recognize that not all of that is full-time. So you got about a third of people who do freelancing, and then a little more than a third of them who do that on a full-time basis. So we're talking about, you know, just over 10% of the workforce doing full-time freelancing. It's significant. It's a really important part of the economy. I think it provides the type of work that these people who choose this way of working prefer. It gives them flexibility that they want and that they need. But there's no reason to, you know, worry that this is going to be like everybody. You know, I think what's most important is that we have a tight labor market. we keep a tight labor market and people choose the type of work that's the best fit for them. And I think that with the growth of remote work and with people taking a look at what they value in their work circumstances, we are going to see more people choosing to freelance. We're starting to see that already, and I think we're going to continue to see that.
Well, Adam, let me just take you a notch further. Recently, I did an interview with Liz Schuler, the new female president of the AFL-CIO, the first woman president ever in the AFL's history. And we talked about whether this moment where labor has kind of an edge ought to be renegotiating more than just flexibility. When you know, to Vina's point, you see a kind of neutering, if you will, of a lot of the traditional benefits that used to come with employment and jobs. And as we've gone into the gig economy, it's been those benefits have been shorn off. So is this a moment from your perspective looking at issues beyond flexibility, which is you've got part-time work that you can assemble and maybe stack in different ways, but there are other things in this moment that give labor more edge in the process with employers?
I think workers certainly have more bargaining power now. It's important not to take for granted the short-term circumstances we're seeing right now. It's true that there's a lot of bargaining power, but as Vina said, a lot of that's due to short-term things like the UI that just ended and household savings being higher than normal from stimulus payments. What's really important is that we need the Federal Reserve to remain aggressive in keeping labor markets tight. And we can't simply look at around at the high quit rates that we see right now and assume that, you know, the job is done. We've got to keep labor markets tight. That'll be great for bargaining power. That's going to help to, you know, in all sorts of work, improve conditions for workers. And I really don't think that's an issue of, you know, whether people are freelancing or not. That's an issue of, you know, macroeconomics. We need good monetary policy and we need that to sustain. That's good for all workers.
Vina, I don't mean this with any disrespect, but I in your field, both of your field, there's a lot of jargon that I don't understand, and I want our audience to understand. You write a lot about precarious work. What is precarious work? Tell our viewers understand what you're focusing in precarious work and where that, you know, what ledge are those workers out on as you see it?
It's a great question. So precarity definitionally means uncertainty or instability. And so about 15 years ago in the political science literature and the sociology and anthropology literature, we started focusing on the reality that work had shifted. Starting in the late 1970s, there was a shift in how people experienced employment. Instead of having a single employer, being unionized, getting a pension at the end of the day, we saw more and more people working several jobs, not out of choice, but because they needed those jobs to survive. Those people, oftentimes in retail, for example, were subject to just-in-time scheduling where they didn't even know how many hours they were going to work in a given week or when they were going to work in a given week. Oftentimes, they didn't have health insurance. So precarious work refers to work that lacks income certainty and that lacks benefits. And something that I want to really emphasize here is that for many people, particularly in this tight labor market, choosing to leave their work is a choice. But for the folks that I study, and that is low-income, immigrant, racial minority gig workers, the work that they do is not out of volition or out of choice. It is very much because they are marginalized, vulnerable workers, and this is the work that is available to them. And so what's important is not just that we sort of look to what workers want or what workers desire, but understand why they're doing what they're doing. You might think of a company like Uber as a technological innovation that shifts us from the traditional union hiring hall, for example. So the traditional union hiring hall was this market mediator that helped workers set prices, that helped workers set working conditions, and allowed them to be free and flexible in the ways that workers are free and flexible. Uber, however, enjoys the price premium that comes from their position as market mediator, and workers, in turn, don't enjoy income stability, and they don't enjoy any of the collective bargaining power that workers had in the union hiring hall. So we can think of this moment actually as a time to combine both great technology and really good policy. And we have a century's worth of excellent academic research suggesting what really good policy might look like right now to bridge the gap in inequalities, right, particularly racialized inequality, and to bridge what workers want and need.
Right. Thank you. Adam, another dimension of this kind of landscape of the economic equation out there in America, there's a study, it's called the Venture Forward Study, that the University of Iowa, UCLA's Anderson School, and I think Arizona State University did in partnership with GoDaddy. GoDaddy is the largest internet registration firm in the United States. And I'm fascinated by this study because when you look at it, you see a literal explosion of really hundreds of thousands of new micro businesses. They call them ventures. And in them, if you look, there's a lot in frankly, the minority communities, the black and brown communities, new immigrant communities are creating, you know, what they call side hustles. And I'm interested in whether that is a strategy to cope, a strategy to be more resilient. It's another way of talking about the gig world, perhaps, but it is something I feel it is a little bit different. And you can kind of see a strength there that may not be recognized by many. Does Upwork look at that at all? Have you looked at the Venture Forward work?
I've looked at new business registrations, especially, you know, non-employee business registrations, meaning independent businesses, over the pandemic, and we've seen an absolute surge there. So I think that's the same phenomenon you're talking about. I think you're absolutely right, Steve. It's important to focus on the diversity in ways of working in the economy. And while Vena is focused on low-skilled, precarious workers, it's really important to understand that, you know, that's not the freelance economy overall. It's true there are low-skilled workers in the freelance economy. There are also low-skilled employees as well. There are a lot of high-skilled workers in the freelance economy. Upwork is a skilled services platform. You know, we're talking about programmers, data scientists, web mobile software developers, marketing managers, social media strategists. This is high-skilled work, and it's people who choose this way of working. And I think that, you know, a lot of them think of themselves as small business owners. And so it's important not to conflate that with low-skilled work, which can be precarious, but that precarity is not limited to so-called gig work. Low-skilled workers in employment relationship or, you know, in the post-Great Recession era have not done well either. And that's a macroeconomic problem. And if you got rid of low-skilled gig work overnight, those workers would not be better off. They simply wouldn't be. They would still be facing low demand for low-skilled workers. That's a macroeconomic problem. And it's important that we solve it for, you know, everyone through strong labor demand. And that's going to help people who are low-skilled workers who are freelancers and who are traditional employers. And I think it's really narrow and it's really missing the point to see that as a problem that's created by technology versus a problem that's created by macroeconomic policy errors. And, you know, look around. You know, we're in a moment of very strong bargaining power for low-skilled workers. Technology hasn't changed. The low-skilled freelance employers haven't gone away. They're still there. Workers have more bargaining power because we did something about it in the macro economy. And I think that's the right approach. And, you know, so you keep that in mind and also just keep in mind this tremendous diversity that, you know, we're talking about high-skilled small business owners for a lot of these people who want to work this way.
I might argue that all work is skilled. But I also I want to say from a personal perspective, as the child of immigrants, high-skilled immigrants, I can tell you from you know the four decades of my life what it was like for my father to be a small business person and why he chose to be a small business person, and it was not because he had these sort of entrepreneurial desires. It was because he was locked out as a high-skilled worker of a labor market where he might enjoy full-time employment, might enjoy a pension, might enjoy security. And as a result, despite the fact that I had high-skilled parents, I lived a very, very precarious life.
There are ways in which
technology, you know, Upwork, for example, right, here is facilitating a race to the bottom for folks who you call high-skill workers. You can also imagine a policy at the firm level in which you help facilitate high wages instead of facilitating people competing against each other for really the scraps at the bottom of the barrel.
I guess what I'm interested in both of you is when you look at what does a healthier economy look like that actually takes those workers on the lower end, that precarious side, and gives them opportunities through training or support to have ascension in the economy. Is that a fair question? Because I just wonder, in a world where we've seen inequality widen so dramatically, what should we be doing as responsible policymakers to look at how we bridge the gap and begin creating an engine that moves people from one end of the spectrum where Vina's talking about to the other end where Adam is talking about, and where actually people, if they want to basically have flexibility, they can, but they're not living paycheck to paycheck with, you know, where $400 can, you know, sabotage their whole, you know, economic situation. But let me ask Adam first and then Vina to comment on that. Adam?
Sure. The most important thing we can do is have a full employment economy. That's the single most important thing to do. You saw the negative effects of that in the aftermath of the Great Recession. And you've seen it, you know, quite a bit over the last two decades, including, you know, after the tech bubble. We really haven't had a tight labor market in 20 years. That's the single most important thing we can do. And, you know, you can look around today and see, you know, sort of previews of what that'll look like when we get there. Other important policies are the earned income tax credit is a great policy to help increase take-home pay for, you know, low-income workers. The Affordable Care Act was a really important step towards creating more healthcare access, and I think that there's things we can do to strengthen that. In my mind, you know, a full employment, strong economy is the single best policy that we can pursue, and it's important not to take our eyes off that ball.
But I guess, Adam, when we've been near a full economy before, we still had widening inequality. So is there some, what's missing so that we, I'll buy what you said on full employment, but we've had that, you know, or near that before. What would be the dimensions that we should add to it to try to bring so that the gaps aren't widening in society, which have political dimensions, right? We saw that in recent elections in Virginia and elsewhere. So I'm just sort of interested, are there any other pieces of scaffolding that you think we should consider? And then I'll jump to Vina.
So the two pieces of scaffolding are, you know, wage subsidies for low-income workers. And, you know, in addition to a robust welfare state, you know, food stamps are an important component of that, too. Those are important things to do and portable health care. But we haven't had full employment. And I think Vina would agree with me there that we have not had full employment over the last 20 years. The last time we had a full employment economy was the late 1990s. And we started to get closer to one pre-pandemic. And what we saw was that wages at the bottom of the spectrum started to come up. Measures of inequality started to improve, and we were moving in the right direction. And, you know, the important thing is that we get back there faster and that we not take a decade to do it like we did last time. So a tight labor market is not everything, but it's a lot. And it does move those aggregate statistics we want to move. And it was starting to do that.
Vina, your thoughts?
I think that we need to fundamentally shift the power between capital and labor. Over the last 70 years since the passage of Taft-Hartley, it has been very, very difficult for workers in this economy to organize, in this country to organize, unlike any other industrialized nation in the world. There are policy prescriptions that are on the table in Congress right now, the PRO Act, which would make it much easier for workers to organize, much easier to have a seat at the bargaining table, to raise their wages, their working conditions within the firm. Of course, a tight labor market isn't everything if workers still don't have the ability to collectively bargain, to collectively organize, to push for the kind of world that they want, not just in their own lives, but in all of our lives.
Well, let me take it one step further and just get a, you know, kind of a, I used to ask what a meta question is. And when I ask a meta question, I'm not talking about Facebook, but I am going to ask a meta question of both of you. And I'm going to ask this question about how Americans think about work from your perspective, Adam, because, you know, when you kind of look at what we've gone through in the last 4 years, which is kind of an anti-immigrant bias that I think has become part of the American political scene. You know, I sort of look at America as being the very successful brain drain problem for the rest of the world. It was also the muscle drain problem. You had people on both ends of the spectrum coming in to do the work that a lot of Americans didn't want to do. But you also had very smart people from other parts of the world, perhaps like Vina's parents, coming in and going into U.S. universities and whatnot and adding to the mixture. I mean, do you think that part of the dysfunction we see in the U.S. economy today, just short form, has been, you know, essentially we have a changed attitude towards work in America, but we're not letting people in that we need to help be part of this economic equation?
You know, I think immigration is a huge part of the American success story. It's important to let immigrants in. I don't think that labor shortages we're seeing are primarily or even significantly about, lack of immigration, because it's important to understand that when immigrants move to this country, they bring both supply and demand. They buy and they consume in our economy, and they do work in our economy. And, you know, that's a really big picture truth about immigration, and it's important not to just think of them, as simply coming here to work, but they start businesses, they're innovators, they're entrepreneurs, and they're also consumers. And so I don't think that's really what we're seeing in the economy right now is the decline in immigration. However, I do think the decline in immigration is a huge negative for the long run of the economy. I mean, I know, Vina thinks that we're dealing with this, 70-year downward slide and increase in precarity. But the fact of the matter is more people want to move to the United States than want to move to any other country in the world. This is still a place where you can, find good work and make progress. Right. And it's a very desirable location to live in. We should let more people come here.
Vina, I'm going to give you the last word.
Sure. I mean, I largely agree with that. I think that we shouldn't understand, however, from a political and social perspective, immigration primarily through the lens of labor. This isn't just about the economy. People come here for political freedoms, social freedoms, for the ability to live and speak in ways that feel true to them. Mm. And many people, unfortunately, are also leaving. We found in the last 8 years, a lot of people left to go back to their home country. Immigration isn't also necessarily desirable. People leave because they have to leave, because they need something that feels more free, that is more free. And so as we think about immigration and work, it's also really, really important to think about the other dimensions of our society and what's happening with them. There's a real sort of meeting here between labor and freedom of association, freedom of speech, all of these issues. And I think that they need to be seen and worked on together. And that, I think, is particularly important when we think about labor organizing and unionization. A lot of these issues sort of get worked out and dealt with when people have more power, when low-income people will have more power, when immigrants have more power. We can build and continue to build the kinds of robust rights and civil liberties and protections that we want for all.
Well, thank you to you both. These are real big issues, and I should remind our audience there are real human lives and families behind these issues. I'm glad we got to talk about the human dimensions of the future of work. Adam Ozimek, chief economist at Upwork, and Vina Dubal, law professor at the University of California, Hastings. Thanks so much for your candor and your thoughts today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks.
So what's the bottom line? It was happening before, but the COVID pandemic forced billions of people to shift their work, their relationships, just about their whole lives online. These days, as long as there's a huge gap in employment and jobs are everywhere in the United States, workers have just a temporary bit of power. But benefits are under siege, and the power of workers is shrinking, even if you see people quitting to become DoorDash drivers with flexible hours. The truth is that the cards are still stacked against today's workers. Technology opens up opportunities, but it also breeds inequality, not just in India, but in Indiana as well. Right now, too often, instead of technology benefiting people, people are scrambling to benefit technology. And that's the bottom line.